From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
With a deadline later this month looming over the agreement reached by the U.S. and the so-called P5+1 group and Iran over Iran's alleged nuclear program, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released a video which claimed to demonstrate that Iran has been violating the agreement. Although there was no actual evidence presented within the video, it secured most of the media coverage in the U.S. on Monday and Tuesday, while Iran's repeated claims that the U.S. has yet to honor its share of the agreement has barely been reported by American media. This past week, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, was in Washington at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke at an event hosted by Stephen J. Hadley, who is a member of the board of directors of CFR. The following are the opening remarks of Iran's foreign minister at that event.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A very good afternoon, already evening to all of you. It's great to be back in this hall. I'm going to break with tradition. Usually I don't make opening remarks, but I wanted to start with something looking forward rather than discussing things that you've heard me talk about on various news shows. Our region is in dire need of a change. We have seen many conflicts in this region. After the revolution, we were faced with an aggression, use of chemical weapons, followed by situation in Afghanistan, situation between Iraq and Kuwait, situation in Syria, again situation in Iraq, and now the heartbreaking situation in Yemen, where 1 million people are dying from cholera. And much of it is because of anxieties, concerns. Most anxieties and concerns of one of our neighbors about us, which have become almost an obsession. During the Iran-Iraq war, most of you remember when Saddam Hussein started attacking Iranian ships. Now, I don't want to talk about using chemical weapons against Iran. All of you know about that. And since his closest ally, Kuwait, was selling oil for him, and he didn't have many ships in the Persian Gulf, and we wanted to retaliate, so Iranian armed forces started attacking Kuwaiti ships. You remember the Kuwaiti reflagging operation and all of that. As a young diplomat, very young diplomat, I drafted a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, which was then signed by our then foreign minister, my boss, Dr. Velayati, asking the Secretary General of the United Nations to see if he could make regional arrangements in order to avoid the widening of the conflict in the Persian Gulf. That letter later became, this is 1985-86, that letter later became the basis for paragraph 8 in Security Council Resolution 598, which ended the Iran-Iraq war. That paragraph called for, asked the Secretary General to envisage regional arrangements between the littoral states of the Persian Gulf to prevent the widening of the conflict and to prevent further escalation. There was another paragraph, paragraph 5, asking all countries, that meant including the United States, to avoid actions that would further escalate the conflict. Well, we started implementing Resolution 598, paragraphs about ceasefire, withdrawal, even the paragraph that called on the Secretary General to look into the causes for the initiation of the conflict, and the Secretary General later came up with a report saying what everybody already knew, that Iraq had started the war for 8 years, which caused a lot of destruction, but unfortunately, which was a situation where the international community helped the aggressor almost entirely. But the Secretary General never got to paragraph 8, because countries in the region were not that comfortable. In 2 years' time, we ended the Iran-Iraq war in 1988. 2 years' time, Saddam Hussein turned his guns, actually turned their guns, because they had bought all of it for him, against the countries who had provided him with those arms. Kuwait was the primary target. That was not the end of his ambitions. In a message that he sent us, he told us that we are going to have 1,200 kilometers of borders in the Persian Gulf, meaning that he was planning to take over the entire region. And we said at that time, had the Secretary General started implementing paragraph 8 of Resolution 598, we might not be here. We have seen many other catastrophes in our region, starting with that second war. You all call it first Persian Gulf War. For us, it's a second Persian Gulf War, because we had gone through the first Persian Gulf War for 8 years. Your first, second, occupation of Kuwait, liberation of Iraq, then pushing Saddam out of office. All of these happened. A lot of extremism. We had predicted that the third or fourth Persian Gulf War would only lead to further extremism. People did not listen. And now we are facing the situation that we're facing. We believe we need to break this cycle and start anew. How do we do that? We believe in our region we suffer from dialogue deficit. We don't talk to each other. We talk a lot about each other, particularly when we come here. Our neighbors, particularly Saudi Arabia, wants to create an impression that we are an existential threat against them. You just saw a very expensive 2-week tour of the United States, and that was one of the most important messages that wanted to be presented. We need to address, first and foremost, the dialogue deficit. That is why we have suggested in a number of op-eds that I've written, as well as in other presentations, a regional dialogue forum. Something that we should have done in 1988, if not before that. We have the institutional basis for that regional dialogue forum already. A Security Council resolution under Chapter 7 provides for even a United Nations role as an umbrella. Because there are disparities in size and power, and those disparities in size and power would always lead to countries' anxieties. And not all of it is about Iran, just ask Qatar. So these disparities need to be addressed one way or the other, and we believe that this umbrella that the United Nations under paragraph 8 of Resolution 598 provides, Chapter 7 resolution, can assure the smaller states that you don't need to be swallowed by your bigger neighbors. That there is an umbrella of what our Arab friends call international legitimacy, meaning the United Nations. in order to enter this regional dialogue forum, because we are used to this enemy paradigm, the paradigm of exclusion. We need to break away from that paradigm. And we need to provide an environment where we can include everybody. Now, there are 8 states in the Persian Gulf area, the GCC countries, plus Iran and Iraq, and probably even Yemen. Unfortunate situation as it may be, it will not last forever. How they get in? Simple. They need to accept a certain number of principles. As I will talk, you, those of you who have followed Europe, would tell me that you're talking about the Helsinki process. But I'm talking about a process that would be genuinely a Persian Gulf process. A number of principles that we need to accept. Principles should include respect for sovereignty, territorial integrity, inviolability of international borders. You know, countries in the region, if you look at the southern states of the Persian Gulf, they all have territorial claims against one another, and Saudi Arabia probably against all of them. So, inviolability of international borders may sound rather primitive, but it is an extremely important principle. Non-intervention in the internal affairs of each other. We are being accused of intervening. Accused. There are cases of their intervening in our internal affairs. We did not claim that we will take the war into Saudi Arabian territory, but the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia did make that official claim. So if people think we're afraid of talking about the region, no, there is a lot to talk about the region. We simply decided not to deal with it on the when we were discussing the nuclear issue, but there is a lot to ask on the Iranian side about what's happening in our region. So inviolability of border, respect for sovereignty, territorial integrity, non-intervention in the internal affairs of each other, these would constitute the set of principles that in the Helsinki process was used to be called ticket principles. Accepting these principles would constitute the necessary ticket to get into the regional dialogue forum. Then we need to deal with, in addition to just talking to each other at the formal and informal level, we need to deal with the confidence deficit. We have a dialogue deficit and we have a confidence deficit. So we can start talking, working on confidence building measures. Confidence building measures can include joint task forces on issues ranging from nuclear safety, because as you know, Persian Gulf, the literal states of the Persian Gulf, the coast of the Persian Gulf are going to be host to a growing number of nuclear reactors. So concerns about nuclear safety in the Persian Gulf may not be serious, but it may be very soon. To tourism, cultural exchange, all sorts of stuff. Women empowerment, democratic processes, however alien that might be to some. We can discuss, we can have common working groups, task forces dealing with these issues to enable us to talk to one another and to enable us to share experience with each other and to enable us to move away from the current situation of simply coming here and talking to you rather than talking to one another. In order to make this transformation, we hear in the United States a lot about transformational figures. Now let's really do transformation. In order to make a serious transformation, we need to recognize a number of principles in addition to those ticket principles. For us, I mean, these are very simple realities. First, era of zero-sum games, long over. In this world, there can be no winners and losers. We experienced that during the nuclear discussions. Nobody won when we were trying to up the ante against one another, and maybe soon again, in the nuclear fight. When the United States wanted zero centrifuge option, we went from 200 centrifuges to 20,000 centrifuges. So the United States got a net total of 19,800 centrifuges. And we also went from a plus 7 growth to a minus 7 growth. So everybody loses. In a war, there are no winners. Only in the wars of the Middle Ages you could have winners and losers. In the wars of 20th and 21st century, there are no winners. Only the degree and amount of loss will be different. Somebody may lose 100,000 people, somebody else may lose 10,000 people. Somebody may suffer billions upon billions of devastation. Somebody like the United States may spend $7 trillion, according to President Trump, and get nowhere. Everybody loses in a war. In the globalized era, where even emotions are globalized, you cannot have security at the expense of insecurity of others. That's an important understanding. Second understanding, you cannot buy security. And billions upon billions of beautiful military equipment doesn't bring anybody security. Just look at the region. Now, some of our neighbors are coming here trying to compete with one another in buying more weapons in order to attract support and help against the other neighbor who's also buying billions of dollars from me. Security cannot be purchased. Security requires understanding in the region. And something which is most important to realize. The era of hegemonic influence is long gone. I'm not talking about the United States. The United States did try. After the Cold War, all the way, I mean, first Iraq War, you remember New World Order, then New American Century, all of that didn't work. I'm talking about our region. Neither Iran nor Saudi Arabia can be the hegemons of the region. That's a fact. We need to realize and appreciate this fact, however heartbreaking it may be. None of us can become this new hegemon. So, to put it, I mean, in a nice way, not to be offended by each other, let's put it this way. We need to have a strong region, not to be the strongest in the region. In an attempt to be the strongest in the region, to exclude one another from the region, we have managed to destroy the region. Time to break with that. And I'm telling you that Iran is ready for it because we are big enough, old enough, mature enough to appreciate this reality. And I hope that our neighbors can also appreciate it. And I hope other governments would help them in this process of transformation. That is the real transformational change in our region. And I believe unless we make this transformational change, no matter how much weapons the United States will sell to these countries, at the end of the day, the cost for the United States will be much higher than the profits made by the weapons sold. Thank you very much.
That was Iran's Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington last week. After a conversation with some of the members of the CFR board, Foreign Minister Zarif took questions from the audience.
Evelyn Leopold, a resident correspondent at the UN. Nice to see you again, Mr. Minister. Can you explain why Iran is in Syria? Isn't that money spent that could be spent at home to better use?
Well, we are in Syria for the same reason that we went to the aid of the Iraqis and we went to the aid of the Kurds. You see, there is an official narrative here in the United States, and that narrative is being repeated by everybody. And in order for that narrative to be comfortable, they forget some parts. Iran has a consistent record of fighting extremism. We are in Syria to fight extremism. We are in Iraq to fight extremism. But what, I mean, this fits in the narrative, and that is why you hear it. But you don't hear that we were the first country to go to the aid of Mr. Barzani in Iraqi Kurdish region because they were facing the same threat. It's not because he was Shia. It's not because we were exporting revolution to Iraqi Kurdistan. But it was because he was facing the same threat. We respond to a threat that has been created by U.S. allies, by their money, by their ideology, by their arms. They have financed these groups, they have armed these groups, and most importantly, they have provided the ideology of hate for these groups. I hope they stop. I hope the promises of the transformational guy to stop this will be implemented so that the region and the world will be spared of people who are willing to behead innocent individuals, to kill themselves in order to kill a number of more individuals. I hope it works. But till it works, I think you need to thank us for preventing Damascus, Baghdad, and Erbil, mind you, from falling in the hands of ISIS, because then instead of a terrorist organization, you would have had two terrorist states.
Arye Naya, Open Society Foundations. Mr. Foreign Minister, in connection with Syria, over the past 7 years, the assaults on civilians by the Assad regime have been extremely well documented. Many millions of Syrians have fled the country. Are you offended by Iran's support for a regime that uses barrel bombs, chemical weapons, and the like to attack civilians?
Well, let's not use such high moral grounds. Today, they bombed a wedding ceremony in Yemen. 20 people, including the bride, was killed. Are you offended by...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the problem. And they are in Yemen simply to suppress the people. We have said we're not in Syria to support anybody. We have been categorical in condemning the use of chemical weapons, in condemning attacks against civilians. Hold on, in condemning attacks against civilians, period. Using barrel bombs or anything else. We have a track record in the Iran-Iraq war. There are 7 reports by the United Nations of the use of chemical weapons by Iraq. Not a single indication that Iran even retaliated when they were using chemical weapons with U.S. support, with German support. Somebody provided those weapons, somebody provided the airplanes, somebody provided the missiles with which they attacked us. And nobody, I don't see much shame. We are in Syria to prevent a takeover of Syria by the extremists. We do not support any excesses. We have been very clear in our condemnation of the use of chemical weapons in any attack against civilian areas. We continue to insist that there must be respect for international humanitarian law. But let me put it this way. 5 years ago, just about 5 years ago, when I became foreign minister, I presented a 4-point plan to end this bloodshed in Syria. Ceasefire. I mean, is that... tell me if any part of it is outlandish. Ceasefire. An inclusive government of national unity in Syria. Constitutional reform, so that at the end of the day, of course, this has to be done by Syrians, but as just a perspective, at the end of the day, no single person or no single office would hold all the power in Syria. And lastly, elections. That was 5 years ago. Hundreds of thousands of casualties less. Today, same argument applies. We stick to the same proposal. Unfortunately, some believed that if they could drag the United States into the conflict, they could score a military victory. I tried in the meetings of the International Syria Support Group, and if you don't believe me, ask Secretary Kerry, who presided over those meetings, to get a single sentence in the reports of that meeting. There is no military solution to the problem in Syria. And your allies said that with the help of God, we will either get Assad out of government, politically or militarily. And I joked with Secretary Kerry afterwards that by God they mean the United States. And they believed when they started this conflict in Syria, it was the Ramadan of 7 years ago. And they are on the record saying that by the end of Ramadan, Assad will not be in office. Check me out. 7 Ramadans have passed. Many millions of Syrians have become homeless. Those who need to be blamed are those who brought this to the Syrian people, not those who prevented ISIS from taking over Damascus. 3 years ago, when the war erupted in Yemen, we reached an understanding to put an end to the conflict immediately. Then again, ask Secretary Kerry. None of this, rely on my word. Ask Secretary Kerry. We reached an agreement. We convinced the Houthis, because we don't control anybody, but we can use our whatever authority, influence, whatever we have. We convinced them to stop fighting. Your allies insisted that they will have military victory in 3 weeks. The transformational guy needed 3 weeks to score a military victory in order to make sure that his office was secure and his ambitions, domestic ambitions, were secure. 3 years have gone. 1 million people suffer from cholera. They're no closer to a military victory than they were 3 years ago. And we are being blamed by the United States, and they bring a piece of a missile that they claim that they shot in the air. And that piece of a missile, interestingly enough, is so clean to show the emblem of the Standard Institute of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You know what? You use the emblem of the Standard Institute for quality on cheese puffs. I mean, you don't want to show to your missile customer that this missile has quality approved by the Standard Institute. I'm not kidding you. Look at the picture behind Nikki Haley. I mean, these people who wanted a military victory in Syria in order for their careers to take root have continued for 3 years. They've been supported. They've been encouraged. According to Secretary Mattis, the United States is engaged in that war, killing 20 people today, 20 civilians, even the bride in a wedding today. And we are being blamed. I'm saying categorically, let us stop the war in Syria and Iraq and Yemen tomorrow. And if you see Iran not doing its best to stop that war, then you can accuse us of any moral degradation that you want.
I'm currently teaching at Columbia University, and my question is about your relationship with Hezbollah. You just said that you use your influence not necessarily to make people do things. I was struck when Mr. Nasrallah decided to intervene, because that was a very large decision for Hezbollah to intervene, and I'm curious if you could explain how that happened.
They believed, and I think Mr. Nasrallah has said, I'm not his spokesperson, he is quite eloquent in speaking himself, but they believed that they were facing an existential threat. Extremism is a threat to all. Extremists were on their border. Some of them came and took over parts of Lebanese territory, and recently Hezbollah, with the help of the Lebanese army, has been able to kick them out of Lebanon. They face an existential threat, and they have said publicly that they're there to address an existential threat against them. And once that threat is over, they'll be happy to go back home and build their own country.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.